Bruce Bastian, Tomas Boynton, Terry Brown, Judy DeVersa, Greg Fagan.
Here.
Michael Fitzpatrick, David Flanagan.
Here.
Richard Gonzalez.
Here.
Glenn Harvey.
Here.
Bill Klein.
Here.
Tinu Pena.
Here.
Andrew Thompson. And Myron Uman.
Here.
So we have a forum, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. The agenda for February 7th, are there any changes on that? Okay. I'd like to have a motion to adopt it.
I'll make a motion.
Second.
Okay.
Second.
Craig.
Tina. You. Tina's going to go first.
Okay. Any discussion? All in favor?
All right.
Opposed? Okay. Next, the minutes of December the 6th. Are there any questions or comments on those? Okay.
Move approval.
What?
Move approval.
I'd like to have a motion for approval. Who wants to make that motion?
Second.
I made the motion.
Okay. Good. All right,
second.
All in favor?
Second.
Okay, next issue. Comments from the chair. I'd like to welcome you to my first meeting as chair of this committee.
Congratulations.
What's it?
It's a congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. And hopefully we can work this year on many things that is valued to the organization as well as public. The CAC's liaison report.
Sure. You have the printout of the liaison report. Some things I wanted to mention. Number two there, March is Florida Bicycle Month. So not only will the CPA be having a lot of different events throughout the month to promote Bicycle Month, but a lot of the other jurisdictions we're partnering with. So if you ever go to that Bike Pump Beach website, we should be also showing the events for other cities if we can as well. I know West Palm Beach has events and a few other ones. So keep an eye out for that. They're usually pretty fun. And then another thing, out on the table in the lobby, in the hallway, I guess, is our 2017 year in review. So just a few highlights about some major events we had and maybe some documents. So just a good way to refresh on what we did this last year. And I think that's it.
Okay, thank you. General comments from the public. Robert, do you have general comments or specific items?
Nothing today.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Next, moving on, safety performance measures. We have a presentation on that, I believe.
I'll be giving the presentation today. So, Andrew Euler, I do the transition group program, and then also working a lot on performance measures. So you'll see me throughout the next few months presenting on other performance measures that will be required to adopt from a federal level. Now, the presentation that we're presenting today is a bit different than what we provided in the packet. So there's been some new information released and conversation between all the metropolitan planning organizations for the state of Florida and the state DOT and FHWA regarding safety performance measures and targets. So this presentation has been updated with new recommendations from the staff. And I'll highlight those differences throughout the presentation. Just a bit of background on what these performance measures are. So performance-based planning has been been around since MAP 21. Bill Moonhead Progress in the 21st Century around 2012, I believe, under the Obama administration. And that's requiring states, DOTs, and MPOs to adopt performance measures that were in line with federal goals in the MAP 21 language. And you'll see that those set of measures later on, here in a second, another slide, but the MPOs and the state are required to establish targets and then report on those progress annually. And performance-based planning is really, it's been around for a while, there's different names for it, but basically, using information that we have, data, to make investment decisions and policy decisions. So how can we truly, you know, provide increase in safety, and what kind of quantitative results can we get from those, along with congestion and pavement conditions and all that. So performance measure target due dates, so these are the required due dates for all our targets that we need to pass on these federal goals. And the ones we're doing today are safety, but here's some other ones. System performance, so that's dealing with more with roadway congestion and travel reliability. Bridge condition of our bridges, pavement condition, so the surface of the roadway. And there's asset management plan and freight plans, which are at the state level. And then the planning requirements is the staff here at the MPO ensuring that we put all these into our other programming documents. So the long range transportation plan and transportation improvement program, among other things. So today we're doing safety, and in the next few months you all will be seeing these other targets come to us. So into the safety. So we've always had safety as a primary priority and goal here at the TPA. So this is our vision, a safe, efficient, and connected multimodal transportation system. So it's always been a major priority for us here. And here are the five required safety performance measures that the federal government has for states and MPOs. Number of fatalities. The rate of fatalities per 100 million vehicle miles traveled, so that's the amount of total vehicle miles traveled on the roadway in that year for our county. Number of serious injuries, and so those are incapacitating injuries to people. Rate of serious injuries per 100 million vehicle miles traveled, again, so a rate. And then the last one is non-motorized fatalities and non-motorized serious injuries. So how do we come up with this data in this performance-based planning? So law enforcement officers will report to a scene of a crash, right? And then they're going to log all those, all that information. It gets pretty detailed. We have access to a good amount of that information. That all goes into the system that's stored by the Florida Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles Department, so DHSMV. And then the Florida State Safety Office takes their data and actually cleans up a little bit more and puts locations on it, georeferences it, so we have that available for mapping purposes. And they submit not only the data for mapping purposes, but those total numbers to us to review. So in that process, we get all that information and we can figure out where our hot spots are and hot corridors and intersections, and then make other decisions for policy and design and projects. Now, it comes back down to FDOT, and all we have that is because they're the ones reported to U.S. Department of Transportation, or FHWA. So all these performance measures, even though, you know, we'll establish our own targets, we're reporting our targets to the state, but the person, the entity that needs to report to the Department of FHWA is going to be FDOT. So it's really, is the state really meeting its target? And if it's not meeting its target, the repercussions will come back to them and then to us. So it's really that link there that's like ensuring that targets are met. So proposed safety performance targets. So this is different than what you saw in the presentation in the packet that you provided. So FDOT has Vision Zero, and many of you probably have heard articles or other conferences or presentations you've seen, and maybe some of the documents from Department of Transportation on what Vision Zero is, and basically that means that no death is acceptable, right? So their target for 2018 is zero fatalities and zero serious injuries. So there's a incapacitating injury, meaning that no death is acceptable. So that's what they had chosen to go for. And based off that, the TPA staff also is recommending that since they're not acceptable, that we're going to strive for zero fatalities and serious injuries for 2018. And these are aspirational, of course, you all know that, but it's something that we should all strive for. And it's why we are recommending this. Now, when it comes to these targets, and it's going to vary for each performance metric. For safety, we're going to be setting targets annually. So we're going to be reassessing whatever our target is for 2018 when we get into 2018, and then we'll pick a target for 2019. And then that's Vision Zero. That means we're going to strive again for zero fatalities and serious injuries. I'm just going to show some historical trends on some data. Won't get into too much detail. So this is the data that we have from the State Safety Office going back to 2006. And you can see the bars here as the totals, the counts for the, per year. And then you see this blue line here, and that's a trend line of a five-year average. And you see it starts around 2010 because that's including all the past 5 years since that one. And so you can kind of see that trend line over the previous years. For number of fatalities, we had 181 in 2016, and then the recommended target of 2018 is zero. And then for the number of serious injuries, you see 2016 value of 1129 and a target again of zero. So they're all going to be targets of zeros for the recommendation. What you don't see here is 2017. So I know we're already in 2018, but it takes some time for all the data to get into the system and be cleaned up. So what you saw on the timeline of who's involved in this process, you know, so it's going to be the reporting agencies, you know, sheriff's departments and state patrol, reporting to the state, and then them going to the safety office to clean it up, and then we finally get it. So they're usually a few months behind on getting all that data in, so we're expecting to have the 2017 data hopefully by April this year.
Is there an understanding of why the dip in number of fatalities, but not a dip in the, not a significant dip in the number, a comparable dip in the number of serious injuries? Mm-hmm. I mean, I would assume that that has to do with the economic.
Yes, yeah, so but one of the major correlation between crashes is going to be your vehicle miles traveled. So that would, and of course, in an economic recession, you're going to have less vehicle miles traveled, which is going to impact that to an extent. That doesn't really cover, you'll see in the rate in this next slide, doesn't really cover the full reason for this dip. So I'll have to do some more research and figure that out. Hopefully we can get some more information for you about the reasoning for not seeing that same amount of dipping. Good question. So here's the same thing, but for rates of fatalities per 100 million vehicle miles traveled, and then rate of serious injuries. You see those two lines too. Again, it's the same type of sort of average you're seeing long term here, or the 5 year rolling average. So, again, we'll have to look into that. That was a good question that I had as well. So, again, targets are zero. And lastly, the number of non motorized fatalities and serious injuries. So, this 196, and then all the numbers here are also calculated in that total for fatalities and serious injuries that you saw in the previous slides. So if you were to figure out how many of the fatalities and serious injuries are for non-motorized, so pedestrians and bicycles, it's about a 200 or so there compared to, we had about 1129, 181, so around 1200 there, and you're left with about a little over 15% of the total fatalities and serious injuries being non-motorized in 2016. So if you're thinking about who's using the network more, cars compared to pedestrian and bicycles, you know, you're really, these numbers are really skewed towards impacting pedestrians and bicycles more. So.
Excuse me, I have a follow-up question.
Sure.
First question. So when you're looking at fatalities and serious injuries, how do they go about categorizing what falls under each area? Because that will have some, that will correlate to the, how many data is collected and how it's depicted in this graph. Should we not?
Sure. So the it's a good point. So I guess I'll bring up two things. So the first is when they're logging the report, so the officers out there, they're going to log it based on like an injury. I think at this, well, at the injury of the scene, but I think it's also going to be followed up with that police report to the hospital later on. And so for fatalities, it will be a fatality either at the scene or it's also at the hospital later on. So that would be considered a fatality. And serious injury are going to be those incapacitated injuries for car prevention. And then, does that answer the question a little bit? Awesome.
Well, it just means what is incapacitated. Because
yeah.
I mean, if you have, there's a judgment about some of these things, but if it's if the person has to be transported to the hospital, that's hard data.
Right, yeah. I don't know the exact definition of incapacitated off the top of my head, but I guess I don't like assumptions, but I would say if it's a serious injury that ends up in the hospital, you
so in, that. In the federal rules that require these things, is that defined in those?
Well, they define serious injuries as incapacitated injuries.
Oh.
So I didn't define incapacitated injuries. Go down the whole
shift it down the road.
Yes. Another point to mention, though, sort of related, was you see these fatalities and serious injury numbers. And if you ever had a presentation, I think we've had a presentation in the past about health assessments. You know, these are really ones, this is going to be our official numbers that we get reported, because these come from like those crashes out of the system. But you know, there's always those ones that are go unreported for fatalities and serious injuries for pedestrians, and they just go to the hospital, so they have all the information in the hospital. So they're seeing even more than what you see up here. But that's the point to make, that maybe a little higher than what you see here. So what are we doing currently? And we talked about our vision, a safe, efficient, multimodal system. Well, planning, long-range transportation plan, that is our vision and our goals in there. We have our complete streets policy and design guidelines, and then our pedestrian bicycle and safety studies. So that's what I alluded to with the whole crash hotspots. And you can see an example of what that kind of looks like. Some of the maps you can find in that document about those areas. Programming-wise, we have our competitive grant application process for local initiatives and transportation alternatives that both incorporate safety measures into those, so you get a stronger score if you are improving safety in a corridor or with your projects. And then monitoring. So we already do this, you know, we talked about what performance measures are, performance-based planning. We've already really been doing that through our congestion management process, and that's using, you know, data-driven results to figure out how our system's doing. So we've already incorporated a few of that in safety in this document, and that's actually that handout that you all had for your last meeting. And then the bicycle and pedestrian count program. So we have counters set up at different locations that we move around to track some of the activity, so we can make some investment decisions and programming projects based off of where those are occurring. And how do we get there in the future? So what can we do now? I guess this is our order of my presentation. Cannibalized road maintenance projects. This is a strong word here, but you can think of
cannibalized.
Yeah, we had this conversation in the last meeting with TAC. So basically, cannibal sounds like a negative word, but cannibalized is basically taking parts from one piece and using it for another. So basically what we're saying here is, we'll use a different word later on, but basically what we're saying is,
road
maintenance projects.
How about reprogram?
Sure, reprogram. It's a good one. So a lot of these road maintenance projects are just for resurfacing, right? So using those funds in other ways as well while you're out there on the roadway. So not just trying to, you know, to smooth up the pavement, but also providing enhanced striping of crosswalks, designated bike lanes, and marked conflict areas. So those are all really cheap fixes that you just do with the same paint that you'd be doing for the striping anyway. And some other projects that we're doing, that you could be doing with the local cities and then us, construct missing sidewalks and bus facilities, relocation of bus stops, and improved street lighting. Other things to implement complete streets, so we have a complete street guidelines that I mentioned, and that TPA funding programs that we have that are due on March 2nd, and then into the future. So this is sort of looking into to this coming year. So Vision Zero is pretty lofty, an aspirational goal. What other places have been doing is creating a Vision Zero action plan, and we already have a good basis for that with our bicycle and pedestrian safety study, so expand upon that and building off that to release an action plan that can incorporate more of policy and design considerations of what we should really be doing to get to Vision Zero. and then supporting innovative technology. That's pretty open-ended there, but we do have our long-range transition plan coming up for 2045, and we're going to have a greater focus in that plan on innovative technology, so hopefully we can provide some good information in there and how we're going to support those technologies moving forward. And then lastly, just the roundup of what we're trying to do here today. So this is an action item, and we've shown you again what FDOT has is zero fatalities and serious injuries for 2018, and then what our staff recommendation is, and that's supporting the FDOT target of zero fatalities and serious injuries. And around the same time next year, we will come back to you again for 2019 targets.
In any of our the TPA documents, does it identify the contribution of individual projects toward achieving those goals?
That's a good question. So
how do you know how you're going to get there? Mm-hmm. It's great to have all those high-level words, but unless you have a project and you know how it's going to contribute toward one of the goals, whether it be safety goals or performance standards or whatever, you don't know how you're going to get there. So maybe a recommendation for the five-year plan would be, if you have a project and you think it's contributing to safety, show its incremental contribution toward getting there.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point. In our last LRTP, we do prioritize projects in that, and safety is one of those weighting in that. And then any new projects that come on board for local transportation transitional alternatives program projects also have safety as something that we grade. So how well it's contributing to.
But it strictly identifies that it's a safety project.
Correct.
It doesn't identify quantitatively what you think it will do toward bringing down an elevated number to some lower number.
And I think, I don't think I know, we'll be moving towards more of that now that it is a requirement. So when we have newer program projects later on, you know, I foresee that we can more quantifiably figure out how much a project could improve it. So we know if this is a roadway project on a corridor from A to B, 2 mile segment, we know how many crashes have happened there in the past, and we
I think that would be a great task to give the project manager who's bringing the task forward. Mm-hmm. To try to quantify it.
My question is not dissimilar. We know where the hot spots are. Do you have enough detail in the data to be able to calculate some of these performance measures at particular hot spots there and give you goals so that you can make established goals for particular hotspots? Because the hotspots are the hotspots, and usually the best place to make progress is where the problem is the worst.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point to make. And we that was a little bit of discussion we've had at the TAC as well, Technical Advisory Committee. Something I mentioned about, you know, the majority of crashes occurring at key areas. And so we do have our hotspots. Not all of them have products programmed towards them right now. Right now, it's really something for local jurisdictions to use to submit projects. So we're looking into other ways through this to figure out how we can maybe start programming towards those specific areas.
I think it would, you have to prepare a report based on federal rules, and I understand that. But it would seem to me that from a practical perspective, it would be interesting, maybe perhaps useful, to add to what is required in these reports the specificity of, you know, the top five or the top 10 hotspots, so that you can get a sense of where the problems are and where the opportunities are for working more effectively toward the zero goal. Because you're never going to get the zero goal. I mean, I would think a better, from my perspective, a more realistic goal is to reduce the number of fatalities this year over from the next year over this year by 20% or something like that, some number. And so you work down towards zero. But to say that you're going to get zero next year is, you know, you're always going to be short of that goal.
Yeah. So I got a few things to say off that, and that's a good dimension. So if you look at the previous PowerPoint, we did have it going up to 2045 for a zero reduction to give us some room there. But a few things I wanted to mention off of that about meeting our goals. So I did say that the target has a goal, the target recommendation, and what EFTA has is that at zero for fatalities and serious injuries. But to meet your targets, it's not only that, it could also be if there was a reduction from the previous year. So you meet your target either way. If you had, for example, 2016, if you end up with less fatalities in 2017 than you did in 2016, you have met that target, is how they're going to, FH30 ways are going to be approaching it. So in that regard, you meet a target. But, you know, we do agree that it may not be a possibility to reach that in the foreseeable future quickly, but I think it's going off that notion of Vision Zero that's been a very big push nationally and internationally about no fatality being, you know, every life matter. So
I understand that, but perhaps you could use different words, but I mean the formal word for Project Zero, but then have some kind of practical goal for reduction next year over this year. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there's no way of judging whether you've met the performance goal. Mm-hmm.
Any other comments?
Any motion?
Okay. Are we just now here?
We're back to zero.
Correct. Okay. And just to recap, you are either recommending to the board either the supporting FDOT's zero fatalities and serious injuries by 2018 target, or coming up with another recommendation.
How could we support something that's already been exceeded? Mm-hmm. There've already been four fatalities through yesterday.
Mm-hmm. It is an aspirational goal. Yes.
Should we start at four then?
How can you approve something that you know is wrong?
Well,
I don't think we can support anything but zero. Politically,
zero from this point on.
I mean, that's almost politically incorrect. What's a realistic number? Right? Yeah. You can't. You only have one option here.
Exactly. Politically, it's tough to say 200 deaths is okay next year.
I mean, it's.
Mm-hmm. But I think you could say percentage reduction, as you had pointed out. 20% reduction, or you know, you can still put a metrics to it without saying we want fatalities.
Well, they pointed out at the safety summit that the FAA doesn't go around saying this year we only want 200 people to die from airplanes. I mean, other transportation modes have a zero goal, so why not?
Or zero from this point.
Okay.
Yes.
Starting right now.
So I understand the
politics.
The perception of it, and I'm happy to accept a grand goal, but I'd like to see more explicitly what the practical implications of the projects that you have underway, what you expect them to do year over year. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to see something in addition to that, saying that in our planning, we anticipate a reduction next year of 10%, 15%, whatever you think you've got, and then we can measure performance against that, recognizing that there's a zero goal someplace. But
maybe it should be in the 5-year plan. Okay, these projects should reduce fatalities and serious injuries. This project by this project by 10, so in total, the whole TIP shows a goal of a certain amount of reduction in fatalities and serious injuries.
And the only thing is,
yeah, please.
And just, I mean, I'm, it's kind of flip a coin. I'm okay with voting yes to go for it, but at the same time, it doesn't feel right if it's not realistic, because we have more older adults, you know, continuing to drive in Palm Beach County. You know, if we look out 10 years, does it really mean the numbers are going to go down? Success could mean that the numbers go up, but we're doing everything that we can to mitigate people getting hurt or injured needlessly. So, I mean, it works as a good bumper sticker, but I do also share your same concerns that it's just not realistic, you know, just to say zero.
Yes, just as a reference point, the county engineer's office, through their five-year road program, keeps a list of all of the major intersection hotspots, and that list pretty much floats in that same top 10, other than when they do improvements to those intersections, lighting, visibility, etc., expanding the roads. So a lot of that data goes into the road program and improvement program and I-95. So it's not like this is a void that nobody pays attention to. It's paid attention to every single day. And when people die, there's a lot of calls to go to the county commissioners to try to do something about those intersections. And we do have, we live in a tourist area, we have a lot of retirees in here. For example, for God, 10 years, I think Linton Military Trail was the number one intersection crash. Number two was PGA and Prosperity. There's no visibility, there's no turn lanes, and those are just two areas. I haven't seen the list probably in 10 years or five or whatever it is, but I mean, this isn't you have to say zero fatalities, but there are mechanisms that are in place in addition to what was just presented here. We're trying to get to those hotspots. I-95 is a huge one. Oh, is that counted? That's not really in the county, but they keep track of it.
Sure.
That's huge. Oh, high speed, high volume.
Then there's also the pedestrian fatalities, of which there were 200 in 2016,
pedestrians and bicycles.
Some of that is, you know, pedestrians and bicycles, and some of that is people running across the street, jaywalking, and others are vehicles making right-hand turns without watching for bicycles coming the other way. I'd like to move approval or the recommendation that the board approve this. But I would also like to ask staff, for example, is Glenn's suggestion that some part of the TIP be explicit about which projects contribute to the expectation of improved safety, and what those what the expectation is in the reduction or the change in these parameters over the next 5 years would be. Is that something practical for you?
Yes. So when it comes to plan requirements, we are required to put it into our transition group program and our long-range transportation plan. So what we ultimately adopt at the board, those performance measures are going to be mentioned in the TIP, and with that, we will state, I believe, how much money is going towards safety improvements, so which products are going towards safety improvements. And I foresee at the future that we would have, I would like to envision that each product in the TIP, each one that's mentioned, has some a way of showing that there's a safety aspect to that project, either through a scoring mechanism, but we are going to incorporate it in there. I think the first time we incorporate it in there might be higher level, and we get better at it over time in the next year, but it's required to be incorporated into the TSP. I'm not sure if anyone wants to expand this.
Did you mention the Vision Zero plan?
Yes.
Did I already mention that?
As I mentioned before, it's February now, so we were saying, and we have in our unified plan and work program for the coming year, to make this Vision Zero action plan to incorporate some of the things that you all mentioned. So Myron mentioned a policy decision or design consideration about limiting those right turns on red, or you know, having a red with no right turns at intersections where pedestrians can cross. So that's a policy decision that might go in there. There's other things that you can put into the Vision Zero action plan for us to approve, and then by February 2019. So we're hoping to come back to all of you by next year, begin next year with this plan to see, you know, how can we really reduce fatalities and injuries in more detail.
Because your goal in 2045 is zero.
So you're...
No, it's 2018 now.
No. But their goal is Horizon 2045 zero. So when we do the long-range plan, which is ending in 2045, then that should be a significant portion of which projects are going to get us to zero in 2045, according with your goal.
So the thing is, what you're looking at is in reference to the one that was handed out in the packet. And since then, I know that's just last week, but since then we had more conversation with the MPOs at the state and FDOT. And actually, we're not going with interim goals. So he's referring to the fact that it had 2045 showing zero fatalities and serious injuries, and then interim goals at a linear way all the way up to that. And what I'm saying is that we're switching to a target of zero by 2018. This is more aspirational than what you'll see in that packet.
Right.
So this is a different recommendation.
Yeah. No, it's a recommendation that builds to get to 2045 at zero.
But
it's zero now. It's up this way rather than a. But it should be, you know, it'd be interesting to see how it's addressed in the long range plan. Because that's really where you have enough time to start changing attitudes, construction, and everything else.
I think that some of my concerns might be alleviated when we see the zero action plan a year from now. But I'd like to suggest that you engage with some of us or the committee as a whole on what ought to be in that action plan and how it ought to be described to the public. We're supposed to represent citizens, right? And communication with the citizenry is, I think, one of the important roles, the challenges that the TPA has. Maybe we could help in that regard, but I'd love to see that action plan focus on the hotspots and what we're doing with those hotspots to achieve better results. And if that works, then I'm happy to if that's the idea for the next year's planning, I'm happy to move the recommendation of this thing to the board.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I could, I think this has been a fantastic discussion, and I really appreciate the insights. Maybe a recommendation the committee would like to consider is that you move approval with a request that we evaluate the safety benefits of the projects that will be built in the coming year. So tell us, and I think, you know, as I'm hearing you guys talk your way through this, I think this is something I'm gonna do anyway, but maybe you take it as a recommendation and say, tell us to look at the crash history for the 5 years preceding a construction project, document what you built, and then look at the crash history for the next 3 to 5 years to document the change.
Mm-hmm.
Because really, the impacts happen on a location basis.
Mm-hmm.
We can talk about wanting countywide Vision Zero, but it's gonna happen through interventions that occur in a particular location with a particular change. So we want to measure the beneficial impacts of those changes as we go forward. And maybe that's an annual presentation as we update our Vision Zero commitment. We can say, these are the projects that were built in the preceding year, and this is what we've seen thus far since their completion. That kind of practice, I think, would integrate the discussion a little bit and focus it a little better. Our action plan, while I don't want to undersell it, is going to be focused more on what should we build next, not evaluating the projects that are already in the pipeline for the next 5 years.
Well, wouldn't you expect on an annual basis your action plan to review what's happened in the last year and in that respect?
I think that's a reasonable commitment of that document. But maybe you recommend that that be a commitment of our agency as we go with, you know, don't wait around for a year. Start doing it now.
And I think that's good, but it's somewhat reactive. So on projects you're evaluating, I would like to see, what do you think it's going to do? What improvement do you think it's going to make? Don't wait until the project has already been implemented.
Sure.
But I think that's correct. I agree. And that's why I was talking about the TIF.
Yeah, and I agree with you.
Because, you know, that will say, okay, in the 5 years, these projects over the next 5 years, when they're up and running, should reduce fatalities by this much and serious injuries by that much. And by project, to show them. So I think it leads, I take what Nick said, lead it into the expectation for not only doing the projects that are being complete now, so that we can start that process to start focusing on the plan that we're approving gives us what kind of reduction in fatalities. Would you like to make a motion?
I'll try to, and help me with this. I'd like to recommend we approve this presentation with a commitment by the TPA staff to evaluate current and future projects for contribution to the safety goal. Is that?
Should we recommend or
acceptable to you, Nick? Or
should we say recommend, Nick?
You're ultimately a recommending body, so whatever
yeah,
you tell me is a recommendation.
We okay. can't do
whatever words you use.
Well, we recommend
it as such.
We recommend to the board, right?
Yes. Okay.
So we would recommend that the board adopt a policy.
Policy or procedure.
Or that the board direct staff to analyze the contributions to improved safety of projects in the 5-year plan?
Current projects in construction as well as in future projects.
For their contributions to improving safety. And I think that, there's a lot of data to be gathered in what I'm about to say, but I think Nick is correct. You look at the five-year record before you complete a project, and you follow a project for 5 years thereafter, and you make a judgment about whether you've actually improved safety. 1 year doesn't count.
Thank you. Do we have a second to that?
Second.
Second.
Can
we clean up the language?
Yeah. It's going to be difficult.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I also need to make sure that we, because the main requirement here also is target setting. So we need a 2018 target. So remember that, because the zero fatalities and serious injuries is what we're recommending. So
I think the motion said we accept.
Great.
Okay. Just making sure. Show the board.
Okay.
All right. All in. Any other discussion?
There was a young lady who asked for cleaning up the language.
Well, no, we have a lot of odds and ends added in, and what we're basically doing is saying that we're going along with staff's recommendation to approve this vision of zero fatalities and serious injury reduction. It's an objective, and it's to me it's hard to pick a number, 10%, 20%, 30%, but to see some improvement would be an achieved goal. And the more improvement, the better. I'm just looking for something a little easier to navigate through.
But the problem you end up with is that if you pick any goal other than zero.
Zero works for me. I mean, I understand it's just a goal.
Right.
I mean,
but if you pick any goal other than zero, you're saying deaths and injuries are acceptable.
Right, and zero works for me. I'm just looking.
I think zero's fine.
A little clarity as far as the evaluation midterm, so to speak.
Right.
You know, let's take a look at how well are we doing? And these hotspots have to share things in common, like every hotspot doesn't have enough turn lanes, or it's got too much traffic at given hours, and maybe at given hours something has to change. But I think there are a lot of ways of working our way through this, and I just like the clearer, simpler language. The measurement, I think, is good. He said he will do that. In fact, he was thinking of that being part of the program. So I'm looking at something that we can send on to the board that is a clear step saying, yes, we approve this concept, and we'd like to see this done as well.
Can you read it back? The
I was actually going to ask you guys to clarify the motion, because it's a little bit all over the place.
Okay. So the 3 points that I have written down are recommending approval to the board of the Vision Zero target, so zero fatalities and serious injuries for 2018, as well as pursuing the action plan by February 2019 for Vision Zero, and as well as the TPA staff to evaluate the projects and how well they are contributing towards safety and the transportation improvement program.
Current projects and construction and future projects.
That sounds a lot cleaner.
Okay. Yeah. So I have
That's fine. Okay. I think that would send a message to the board that we're interested not just in the formality of the presentation, but in real progress and how to measure real progress. It's wonderful. I think the idea of performance measures is wonderful, but you also have to measure your progress against real numbers.
Well, and that I agree totally with you, and I think the comment to measure the projects that are currently under construction to say, okay, what should they do as far as reductions in deaths and serious injuries? And after they're in place, did that come true? And then for the going forward, the TIP and the 20-year plan, how will each project achieve the goal of zero?
I know.
Any other comments?
I know we're having a lot of discussion, but I do feel, in true analyzation, we should be looking at somewhat more at the hot spots. You know, and that wasn't part of the motion that we just put, because if we're just looking at each program by itself and just saying, well, is it doing something good that's promoting safety, we don't really get a better analysis of what are common features that we're seeing that are causing these actions, and then help us to make a decision to do something different.
But I think you'd be using your HubSpot data to develop your future projects. So it happens.
So what happens is I'm seeing it being more of an analysis of every single project, and then everything gets lost in the weeds instead of us really fine-tuning. These are problem areas, Prosperity and PGA. What does it have in common with military and this, that we're getting, you know, this many bike fatalities? Then now we can really start analyzing what we can do differently to improve the numbers, instead of saying, well, we're hypothetically thinking this thing will cause this much safety. Did it do that or did it not do that?
I agree with you, Tomas. The problem is how do you express that when the TIP is already there? They've got this layout of projects. Mm-hmm. Some of the projects will be about hotspots. It seems to me that if we insist that the action plan comes out a year from now and every year thereafter prioritizes or describes the hotspots and what they're doing with them, then at least we can, you know, apply some kind of pressure that way that they focus more on hotspots for safety reasons.
What I would expect to happen, because you're asking the engineer to determine the safety benefit of a project, they're going to start being focused on that issue. They may not have been focused on that issue previously. Mm-hmm. You know, it may have been, well, there's not enough turn lanes, let's put a few in. Mm-hmm. Without saying, okay, that'll generate a reduction in the number of fatalities. Now they're going to have to say, okay, this project, whether in a hotspot or a non-hotspot, and then the reviewers will say, okay, well, if this doesn't help reduce fatalities or serious injuries, should it be as high as it is?
The only issue that I have is that, and after this I'm ready to vote, but I mean, if we do something that promotes more people to use bikes, realistically, the amount of bike fatalities is going to increase.
Right.
So for us to say, we're going to go on US 1 and we're going to start putting in safety bike, you know, medians and different things that we can do, and we do get a surge in people now saying, hey, let's do this. This is, I'm enjoying biking. Inversely, though, the engineer is going to say, well, we're expecting 3,000 more people to use this a week. Just by chances, the number is actually going to go up of these fatalities. I mean, and so like a project would be that's promoting other forms of non-vehicular transportation could look negative when in actuality it's a positive.
But you need to look at all of the signage, not just one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The band once said a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin with a small
mind. Okay. I'm ready to vote. I think that works. I need a second.
In a second.
I just want to comment that there's one needs to be cautious about asking the engineers to describe the safety implications of their projects. It's a well-known effect that if the government decides that they're going to judge priorities in terms of climate change, everything is described as a climate change improvement. So I'd much rather not worry about that, but look in the long range about 5 years previous and the 5 years after data and see what really happens.
I agree. Okay. We have a motion. We have a recommendation. All in.
Tell me second.
So the initial motion that Myron and Tina made, that's off the table?
It's been adjusted. You've accepted.
Yes, I accept all the changes.
So then Myron.
Whatever changes were made up.
You accept all the changes. Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Again, say nay. Thank you.
So this is the hardest one to go through, so the next months are the easier performance.
So we're moving on to the limited English proficiency LEP plan, February of 2018.
Melissa Bluth, our public information manager, will be presenting this.
Okay. And hopefully the voting on this will be easier, cleaner. As you recall, back in October, just a few months ago, we updated our public participation plan. And part of that, of course, is identifying our different audiences and the different strategies and methods that we're going to use to reach out to them. But today we're here to update two very similar, not similar, but very related plans, as well as to update the branding and the contact information. We also have gone in and updated the data that we use and the content. So first, these are two separate items on your agenda, and I'll ask you to vote on these separately for recommendations to the board, but we'll talk about what each one of these entails. The first is the Limited English Proficiency Plan, and that is basically to understand our changing demographics here in the county. And we have a population of over 1.3 million of ages 5 and older, and our latest data shows us that about 86,000 of those, which is about 6.5%, are identified as LEP individuals. They have limited English proficiency. They have self-identified as either not speaking English or not speaking English well. So that means we need to know who they are, what languages they do speak, how they best receive information, and where they're located, so that we can consider them as we do our outreach program. So the vast majority of those at 5%, just under 5% of the 6.5%, speak Spanish. And before there had been, when we last looked at the data, the next category was now called Haitian, previously referred to as French and Creole, and that is now all lumped into what they call Indo-European languages at only about 1.5% of our county's population. So we've updated the demographics in there, and also we've updated the list of documents and practices that we routinely do and have done recently and will continue to do to reach out to those special populations by translating printed materials, by offering an opportunity for translations at meetings, and that type of thing. And as we go forward with our LRTP, I'm sure we'll continue some of the same practices that we did for the 2040 LRTP to provide materials in other languages as well, on select basis. The second document that we're going to consider is very similar or related. It is our non-discrimination policy and plan, both for Title VI protected classes and for ADA, for the disabled populations. And one of the requirements is that there be a staff person specifically identified as the go-to person, so the public has one contact person. And I have been that person for several years, so I've updated my contact information in there. It includes our non-discrimination policy statement that basically says that we're going to ensure that the TPA will in no way discriminate or against any protected class, and that refers to Title VI and the various federal different protected classes. But also, we can carry it over the same language that we've had for several years that says the TPA extends these same assurances to any protected class as recognized by any of the local governments within its service area. So it's not limited strictly to the Title VI protected classes. So we have the policy statement. We have in there also a statement that we're committed to protect or to serve those with limited English proficiency that we just spoke about, and also to serve those with disabilities. And then at the end, we have the whole complaint process, a complaint form, and that complaint form already was provided in both English and Spanish. And the next steps are that I wanted to point out that these are two distinctly separate documents, and they are separate from the PPP, but we have our PPP written and these written to where the latest adopted versions of each of these documents become appendices to the latest adopted version of the PPP. So the public can go to one place and read the latest adopted versions of all of these in a combined format. And so these will be added to the new PPP. And we've also decided we're going to make the commitment to translate the entirety of both of these documents into Spanish. As I said, the complaint form is already provided in Spanish, but if you can't really read the whole document and you don't know that the last four pages also offer the Spanish, so just to make it easier to reach out to that Spanish-speaking population that is the largest part of our limited English proficiency audience in the county.
Will the public participation plan also be in Spanish?
We haven't made the commitment to translate that entirely because so many of our documents are provided or available. Either they can be, you can use Google Translate to put data into them from our PDFs, or also our website, of course, is in there. So we certainly can consider translating the entire PPP. We have not, at this point, made that commitment. And again, just my contact information is the designated person for the LEP and the Title VI. So if anyone with any comments or questions, we found a few little changes. We're going to make some minor updates, mostly formatting, but we'd be happy to receive any comments that any of you have.
Yes. Just a quick question about the demographics. 70% of my employees are Haitian American. And so when you say the majority of people within Palm Beach County, or the majority of the, how did you put it, the, I call them ESOLs, limited English proficiency people, I always go back to the old English as a second language people. I don't understand is that about the, where'd you get the information about which population is heavier, whether it be the, we always used to call it Creole, but it is Haitian now? They don't say Creole anymore? Creole speakers?
Yeah, I have a clarification on that.
Haitian? Okay.
That, and I don't know your industry, your business, or
transportation.
They color that specifically. Mm-hmm. But the data source for this is the U.S. Census Bureau's American Community Survey for 2012 to 2016. So that was the latest data that was available, and we did keep a record of that data, so the next time we look at this a year from now and consider updating it, or as soon as updated data is available, we'll make sure we're comparing apples to apples. But yes, it no longer breaks out the Haitian specifically. But that is a very small percentage of our population, so your industry
Well, also the Boynton Beach, which is, you know, a very large
location of the Navy part of it. Yes.
You mentioned inter-European. I mean, I thought you were reading
Indo-European languages.
What's that?
It's a long list of pretty much everything except for English.
Is that the Census Department definition?
Yes.
Okay.
That's the category that they use now. So it's also a little bit difficult to look at this to the last one we did several years ago because the categories were different, but actually, if you're looking just at the Spanish numbers, it looks like the Spanish numbers are also going down. So does that mean our population is changing? Does it mean more of them are learning and speaking English comfortably? You know, subject to interpretation, but we were kind of surprised at the direction of those numbers.
Is that instead of the Haitian Creole now, Indo-European?
Well, Haitian is now the term that they're using, as I understand it. Haitian is the term that we're using now rather than French Creole or Creole, but that would all be captured as part of the larger category of Indo-European languages.
Okay.
But I think it's a long list of a lot of other languages in there. But all of that together, all of the Indo-European, presumably includes Haitian as well, for our population is 1.4%. The Spanish population is 4.62%, 61,000 here in Palm Beach County.
It's in the, it's in this document.
Okay.
Yeah, when you look at the document, it's the little colorful table.
And those are people who say that,
page five.
They don't speak English.
Mm-hmm.
So there are plenty of people, plenty more people who speak Spanish but also speak English. So they would have self-identified as being able to speak English, to be able to deal with English.
Sure. Yeah, so these are the ones that say they don't speak English at all or not very well.
Mm-hmm.
So we know we need to deliver in other languages to reach those people. Any questions?
Any more comments? Yes?
A little bit on the side, because it's not quite Title V, but it's kind of in the news, and just, since we're quasi-county, sexual harassment, where does that fall under? I mean, I don't think it's Title V, we won't discriminate, but it's, do we have policies, does it mimic the counties?
Just to go back to where we included this language several years ago, and we have not changed it this time, that we extend these same assurances for not to protect from discrimination. Same assurances to any protected class as recognized by any of the local governments within our service area. I know at the time we did this several years ago, certain governments, I think like Worth was one, that certain ones were identifying specific protected classes that they chose to protect, and rather than try to keep up with that and update this document constantly, we just thought we would put in a nice broad statement because we don't intend to discriminate against anyone. Fortunately, we've never had any complaints whatsoever, and we're not really out delivering projects. We're not doing the community level outreach when a project actually is done. That's really more DOT and the local government. So we're not really in a position to easily, you know, breach this, but we want to be very cognizant of it and the ramifications on the local community of any project that we fund and support.
Mm-hmm. This is just more due diligence in terms of, I think, all organizations and agencies have to be aware that sexual harassment has been happening. I don't feel or have any inclinations that it's happening here, but I'm asking because I don't know when we can bring this up again.
Right. So
that's what I'm saying. I think it's a separate question than this, but I don't know if it really falls under this. But do we, if we were the county, I know the county has policies and procedures. The TPA is kind of its own entity, and so I know some things it follows under the county and some things it doesn't, and that's what my question. For reporting sexual harassment, do we follow the county guidelines?
That would be a question for Nick, but as long as we're part of the county, I would certainly suggest yes, because we are county employees. But this is focusing on protected classes.
Mm-hmm.
So when someone says, I feel like you built that highway right through my neighborhood because I am fill in the blank, I am a certain minority, a certain income level, you know, a certain class of people, that you feel that you were discriminated against collectively because of one of those target groups.
This was just probably one of the only times I could think of actually bringing this up. So I guess it's not part of this, but at the same time, it's something that I think I want to make sure is at the forefront, that we're, all our policies are up to the highest standards that could be there, just so that there are never questions in the future.
I'd like to make a motion that we recommend approval of the LEP.
Second.
I'm sorry, I just want to address Tomas's question. Yes, we would fall under the county for that, for reporting sexual harassment.
Okay, all right, thank you.
Can we do these together?
No.
Recommended separately.
So Mike, you're recommending the LEP?
Yes.
Okay, second? Second, Richard. All in favor, any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed, nay? Passes.
I'd like to make a motion that we recommend approval of the Title VI and ADA non-discrimination policy.
And I second.
Judy, second. Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Then we go to the Okeechobee Boulevard.
One thing from City of West Palm Beach.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for having me. So my name is Wen Deng. I work in the engineering department with the City of West Palm Beach. A little change in discussion today. We'll be talking as the Okeechobee as part of the downtown mobility as a whole. We're so excited to take part of this very large-scale planning process. And I do have to apologize to the TPA staff. They've probably seen this 100 times at this point. So we are doing a few series of studying. Okeechobee is one of it. The downtown parking management, a very long name. It's ultimately, it's the parking study. We have to study mobility along with parking. Also, we're doing the master planning of our bicycle network and the Yale Public Life study. It's essentially studying what's our favorite thing about the city. How do we get people to stay? So ultimately, we're a small city, large in this scale in the South Florida, a little over 100,000, but the majority of us still drives. And you know that earlier when you were talking about Vision Zero as your discussion, you know, we're still a very driving community. And as we grow, how do we manage that? How do we mitigate impacts? We know that we can't build our way out of congestions, especially in the downtown area. We just have no more land. So we have to look at different strategies on how to attack this. This is the City of West Palm Beach, and you guys probably come down happy hour from time to time. We have a lot of events. Boat show is coming up at the beginning of March. We're a very vibrant city, but what we see on the news is actually all these grave issues. Like, it's not so nice. There's always traffic congestion. What's going on with the train? So this is what we keep on seeing. And for those who live in the downtown area, that work in the downtown area, this is what we see. This is just some snapshots of Okeechobee. And if you live there and you happen to walk through this corridor at night, it's actually pretty dark. So we got to figure out how do we address all of these as a strategies. So very similar to the MPOs with the TPA's map earlier, we do have some hotspots. And what we found is 25% of crashes in the City of West Palm Beach as a whole is actually in downtown, and a third of it is on Okeechobee, and 90% of that is at the intersections. So you have to understand, right now we are prioritizing for through movements, cars. How do we get cars quickly through the corridor? And that's not necessarily the direction that we should focus in a more urban environment. So we had a lot of public meetings. I would say at this point, I'm probably have presented over 60 times since the beginning of 2017. So, but you know, we were, I would say it was very successful. Over 600 people showed up in a 4-day course of our charrette. So we sat down, everybody took out their pens and everybody sketched out an idea. You have an idea, you sketch it, and we consider everybody's idea. And ultimately, you know, as we gather all this information, we brought it back. And we spent a lot of time coming up with what's our visioning, what's our strategy, and how do we connect our neighborhoods, and how do we become a welcoming city, and how do we become more resilient? And I'm not talking about resilient as, you know, sustainability goals. How do we plant more trees? The mayor has given us direction to plant over $1 million worth of trees. I'm not sure how many years it's going to get us to spend that $1 million, but I bet you I can spend it pretty quick. You know, how do we be, especially when we talk about resilient, you know, we can't barely keep up with our infrastructure, our needs, our potholes are coming up everywhere. Can we live with a little less? You know, can we live with more green space, and can we make that mode shift? How do we move in the future? So, you know, and really like prioritizing like walking and biking, as you saw the data earlier, those are the most vulnerable. We know that you have 80% of living if you are in a traffic accident that's less than 25 miles per hour. So, you know, slower speed actually saves lives. But, you know, we're still, we want to drive really fast, right? We like I-95, we like Southern Boulevard. So, but in our downtown area, how do we prioritize that? And obviously, you know, how do we create a walkable community? As I mentioned earlier, planting more trees. We're flat in Florida, but it's actually pretty hot during the summer. And we're a very diverse community, and I'm not talking about people of different skin color. We're actually diverse as in our age group. The city of West Palm Beach average age is 39. We're a pretty young city, but we have also a pretty large retirement community that lives in the downtown area, so how can we make it more comfortable for them to walk?
Why are you whispering?
You are whispering.
She's whispering.
When you say retirement community, it's
a secret.
We do, it's no secret. We have no
secret.
I have to admit, I came from the New York City tri-state area, and when I came down here, I learned a new word. It's called season, and you know, the first year I didn't know what it was, but after you know a few years being down here, I'm like, okay, I understand season. We love this weather. This is why people come to Florida. You know, primarily, how do we make it comfortable when people get to downtown? How do we get them around comfortably? You know, how do we increase our network? So right now, walking and biking, that's our priority, right? You guys know, when we vacation, we love to take transit. We love to walk. When we go to Boston, when we go to some European city, we just love to use the bike share station, or we love to walk somewhere, or we take transit. But you wouldn't necessarily visit Stavros 7 in Okeechobee, right? That's not a place to visit. So how do we increase our bicycle network in the downtown area? And right now, our plan shows that we're going to increase it by 600%. We don't have much right now. And what we meant is, you know, we believe in biking as fast people and not necessarily biking as slow cars. So what we meant by when we're increasing our network is we want to make sure that the city streets are comfortable enough that you can bike on the streets, okay? And when the streets are a little fast, then we need separated protected facilities. And that's what our focus is. So 600%, I mean, we're pretty proud of ourselves, but we didn't have much to start with. And then on top of that, you know, we do have a trolley system right now. You know, it's actually has really good ridership. But how do we make that to connect places? How do we connect all of our garages? How do you park once and then we take you to all the amenities that you need? We are looking to rerouting our trolley network and also revisioning if the trolleys in the future are going to stay the trolley or they're going to evolve to microtransit or even larger transit opportunities. You know, for example, creating a parking ride on Okeechobee. How do we bring people into the downtown area so that they don't have to drive? How do we supplement that? Perfect. The other piece of it is transit, and what I want to talk about this in particular right here is because we know that we've identified some streets in the downtown area, and I'll give you an example. It's Tamarind Avenue. It's right there. You guys know downtown. There's a train station. There's, and then it's really 5 lanes of road for not so many cars most of the time, and it's kind of a blank canvas. So we're looking at that street as an opportunity to turn that into a transit street. We are hoping to work with Palmtran. We've initiated our conversation with them to see if we can stage some buses on Tamarind so that it's easier for a transfer. Because right now the intermodal center is on the other side. So if anybody taking the bus that want to transfer to the train that want to take a bike, they have to jaywalk most of the time or go all the way around to get to these transfer stations. So, you know, transit upgrades is something that we're looking to work with Palmtran. And even though this is a city street and it's going to be part of city funding, that we're committed to make these kind of improvements to, and again, the idea is if we have more frequent, better transit, we're going to open up more shifts or more opportunities for to bring people into downtown as another mode and, in essence, create more roadway capacity for us who still wants to drive.
Next question.
Yes, ma'am.
You said you want to create a transit station right there in Tamarind. Where's there another one? I mean, if someone's going to be parking, I mean, is there something else that's already available?
Right. So this is the existing intermodal center right now, and it's really being like Tamarind is right here. But this is the train track, the SFRTA, so it's quite challenging because if you are dropped off at a bus here, you have to go all the way to Banyan and then connect down if you want to take the train, or if you want to even do a bike share, or even if you want to walk into the Brightline station, whatever that may be. So what we're investigating is, can we stage, not all the buses, maybe a few bus on this side, so that you don't have to cross the track as a barrier.
Unlike many of the other stations, why was there no walkover ever put in at that station?
There is, but what we found is the elevator is broken most of the time. So for and we're talking about 880s. We're a city that we are considering design for children from age 8 to age 80, and a lot of time, I witnessed it myself as. Grandmother barely able to carry her luggage. How do we, and it's because there's no at-grade solution. And the other thing I want to point out at, on this slide is actually our pursuit of the Front Street connection. Because right now, Clearwater dead ends right here and it goes north. And then Front Street is here that goes all the way east-west. Brightline station opened, we actually lost 2 crossing, Evernia and Datura. So we really needed a grid network downtown. And what we found in our study that this alleviates over 600 trips during peak hours. So it actually takes congestions off of Okeechobee and off of Banyan during morning and afternoon peak hours.
So just going back to the staging of the buses, I drive that corridor quite frequently and I can't imagine where you would stage the bus.
Mm-hmm.
So have you ever considered in your planning, conceptual plan development, the use of trolley to help move people from the train station back and forth to connect to Brightline or to the other modes of transportation you have along First Street?
Oh, definitely. But you still have the barrier of the train tracks. And we did have, the studies in the past of how many people jaywalking, through that area. You have to understand the intermodal center is still on the west side, and you're still being, it's not very connected from a walking perspective. So transferring, yes, I completely agree with you. It only works if we have other connection points. And the intention of this trolley expansion and rerouting is to bring, 2 of our trolley lines at that location. So if you're taking the bus and it terminates at that location and you need to go, for example, down to City Place, yes, you can walk 5 blocks, or you can hop on a trolley and they'll take you right in front. That's the intention. So do you have any
questions?
I do. Okay, so so I guess this whole study is for just West Palm, downtown West Palm Beach?
It's only for downtown West Palm as our study limit.
Okay, because yeah. I was going to ask about, you know, how do you connect the people on the kind of western side the train track to be able to come downtown? I know you mentioned a parking lot.
Right. There's really what we're dependent on, especially West, is the transit opportunities, because we know that's going to solve a lot of our congestion strategies in the future. And yes, parking ride, we're exploring. Maybe there's some stores that's not doing so well. There's a vacant parking lot just sitting there. How can we approach them and enter into some kind of agreement and run our trolleys every 6 minutes in the morning so we can get people in and out? The other piece to it is I know biking is very important, and that's an active mode of transportation that we see people, there's an opportunity for us to increase that frequency. And you know, how do we provide safe biking east and west? And really Okeechobee, if you think about Okeechobee, is the gateway, because the next crossing north and south is actually very, very far. It's not very, you're not going to be able to get people to bike all the way down to Belvedere and then go all the way north back to, you know, it's just a long kind of route way just to get downtown. So ultimately, all this, you know, we're making all these strategies, and it really is to help figure out how do we connect a network. And we talked about internally, it's not one thing that we have to do. We have to tackle all of it, and it's not just capital improvement. It has to be policies. You know, we kind of talked about what are some short-term strategies that we can improve. And I know you can read, so I'm actually going to focus on Vision Zero that you guys had discussion earlier. And I'm very excited that the TPA is adopting Vision Zero. And, you know, we also want to adopt Vision Zero. And, you know, we know it's not that simple. It's not going to be just capital improvement. This Vision Zero, for example, New York City is actually three E's. It's engineering, enforcement, and education. It all has to go hand in hand. And these are the three, you know, I think Fort Lauderdale has five E's, right? So, no, we're willing to go that many, but three E's seems like it's a lot of E's already. But but ultimately, we know that there has to be a lot of education. And I heard someone spoke earlier, you know, a lot of someone jaywalking, you know, that's an educational piece. Or maybe, you know, maybe we need a mid-block crosswalk, so maybe we can tackle time. We know that when New York City implemented their Vision Zero, it actually, within the first 3 years, their accident and death rates decreased by 23%, while the rest of the country is reporting of an increase of 14%. So we know these strategies work, and we know that we can't achieve it immediately. So obviously, we haven't talked about it internally, but we're looking at maybe a 10 to 15 year goal to actually reach to that point. I commend the TPA and the zero goal. I think that's great because, you know, what we're saying is no accidents or death is acceptable. Oh yeah, and parking TDMs, transportation demand management strategies. And really these are, you know, as developers come in, how can we encourage better behaviors? Can we put work with them to put showers and lockers in their you know, their buildings so people can bike and walk to work so they have a place to change? Can we work with them to get a trolley stop? Are there, you know, can we replace some parking spaces with Zipcar? Because we know one parking space, you know, you can, it's, you can replace 18 on average parking spaces with one Zipcar. So these are things that we have a whole list of it. I'm more happy to share with you guys. You know, of the things that we're approaching as we're meeting our transportation mobility goals. And so I know, no more words. So now we're at pictures. So let's look at Quadrille today. Quadrille Boulevard is actually, this is right in front of the Brightline station, right there. And today is four lanes. We actually had a few deaths on Quadrille, right by City Place. And very unfortunate, a couple months ago,
and it's it was at, I believe it's at night, and you know, it's something that we have to address immediately. So our biggest thing is, can we make short-term investments and really test out the idea, like really embracing this whole concept of tactical urbanism, and before we make a $5 to $7 million investment. So, you know, maybe there's something that we can take a look at. Not saying that our trees will be that green or that big immediately, but maybe we can put up some protected bike lanes. You know, we know the capacity on Federal Boulevard doesn't really meet a four-lane roadway capacity, because north of this area is two lanes, and south of it is a really busy intersection. So are you gonna, do you really need four lanes at this location? So maybe we can take a look at some short-term interventions to help us increase our you know, active mode transportation. And then one day when we have lots and lots and lots of money, because that's what the city of West Palm Beach has, that we can really build a protected, separated bike facility. And then we know there's a lot of work that we have to do for long-term improvements. You know, these intersections are huge intersections. You know, some have reported that it took over 5 minutes to cross some of these intersections. Can we look at mobility hubs, park and rides, as I mentioned earlier, you know, open up Fern Street and then dedicated bus lanes. So this is something that we thought of right now, because the convention center is actually right here, the Hilton. So is there anything that we can do short term, like immediately? Because right now, if you can envision that this area is very clear, there's nothing there, it's ambiguous, it's a little bit unsafe. So can we look at restriping it in a smart way and really put order to our corridor? And again, when we have lots and lots and lots of money, we can look at improving the intersection, such as that. Also, this is Tamarind Avenue, and I'm really focusing on Okeechobee because this is the busiest intersection that we have. You know, can we look at providing more, you know, Dutch-style design where you have a physical barrier that there when a car and bike and walking is not in conflict? Can we get people across the street safely instead of forcing them to go all the way north and to go all the way east? Can we look at the middle area and create a beautiful walkway for people to connect to City Place? You have a question?
Oh, no, I'm actually looking at your striping to see.
That's yeah, and so the intention is, you know, once we make these investments, and we actually put a dollar to all these, it's pretty expensive. We're looking at over $300 million of improvements in downtown West Palm alone, which I think we can tackle about 10% of it right now, but I can't commit to any more than that. You know, again, that's some inspirational pictures. This is on Okeechobee at the tent site, what we call the tent site. It's a plain piece of property in the middle of between the two Okeechobees and Lakeview. And then, you know, can we make it a more walkable environment just to protect, give it some vertical element to so people feel safe when they're walking down the street.
Could you go back?
Yes, ma'am.
Just go back. I wanted to see the difference.
Oh, yeah. Okay. We have a sidewalk, but it's all perception. We have a sidewalk that is probably 8 feet wide up today, but we don't have that vertical element.
Okay.
So, so can we?
No, yeah. I see it.
Okay.
I'm with you.
Yeah. And then ultimately, you know, this is on Australian Boulevard, you know, the bridge, looking west. You know, right now, we're telling people, let's bike right here, you know?
Wow.
And it's okay because everybody's going about 40 miles per hour, so that's not really gonna be encouraging, I'll be honest. I am one of those curious but very afraid to bike on the road. So can we look at it smartly, because everybody bikes on the sidewalk anyway? Can we, you know, make some short-term improvements that will create multi-use?
Okay, what are bikes on the sidewalk? I know in some communities it's a no-no. So is it part of West Palm Beach ordinance to allow people to use the bicycle on?
Let me clarify that. It is a multi-use path, or an elevated raised bike lane. So no, we would never encourage you to bike and walk in the same in the 5-foot sidewalk that's there. But if we can provide 10 to 12 feet where you have distinctly have an area for biking and an area for walking, then yes, we would definitely encourage.
Well, a bike path.
It is
bike path.
A multi-use path, yes.
Yeah.
But then, you know, we know in the future, if you're really going to look at growth and at the way that the city is growing, we have over $2 billion worth of construction right now that's planned to come in, that the only way to battle congestions, you know, demands in the future is to look at making that mode shift and really prioritizing our transit. You know, I know there were discussions with light rail, but the first step to light rail is really dedicated bus lane. So I think that's it.
I can tell you in England, where I visited, they have dedicated bus lanes. It's pretty neat.
It works. We had a discussion earlier today on how Broward County has a dedicated bus lane that uses I-95, and they have a lot of great ridership. So it works if you can provide good enough service, the frequency and the headway. You know, and it has to be a premium service, right? It kind of separates. You guys have a chance to ride Brightline versus Tri-Rail. It is a premium service.
But that wasn't premium. That was their regular bus, and it was on a dedicated bus.
Yeah.
Any questions? Comments? Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think the summary points provided in your packet. Oh. Yes. Any questions about the summary points? Any member comments? Yes.
I have a question, and it's a process question. We passed we adopted a motion earlier that added something to what the staff was going to present to the board. At the next meeting, what is the procedure for informing the board that we had something else to say other than we recommend it?
So when you're looking at your agenda, your action item, I'll have the action item there, and we do have information that was talked about in all the committees as well.
So you'll put the recommendation in. You know, we adopted a motion. And you'll express that in the agenda?
I believe so. Is that correct,
yes.
Mark?
Only your motions are included, like the general language of your motion.
And is there any procedure for actually telling them about it, calling attention to it, or discussing it, or is it just, you know?
But it's ignored. What you're talking about is the recommendation.
Yeah.
That we added to the
motion. The question is,
how is it
conveyed to be discussed at the board meeting? That's my question.
How is it conveyed to the board?
Yeah.
Our recommendation.
We do bring up the committee discussion.
It is.
Yes, sir.
More formally, I guess. Myers?
My question is, what is the procedure for, and how do we know that the board has received our recommendation that differs from just approving the plan?
Motion.
So we write it into the agenda packet, into the item description, the recommended motion text and title, and then the committee's additional recommendation. And then when Andrew presents the item to the governing board, he'll have a slide on it saying, and the citizens committee recommended these additional actions as part of their endorsement or recommended endorsement of the Vision Zero outcome.
Okay, and so we should see in the minutes of that meeting what they did to it.
Yes.
If there's any discussion or whatnot.
Okay. Any other member comments?
Yes, just want to let the members know on February 20th, there's going to be an all-day summit. It's a human services transportation summit. So it's geared towards different nonprofits nonprofits as well as transport agencies that work with individuals, older adults that are transportation disadvantaged. And we'll be going over different initiatives that are being done throughout the region, as well as different technologies that are being used. So it'll be from 8:30 to 4:30. It is in Palm Beach County. It's at the Therapeutic Recreation Center at 2728 Lake Worth Road. I'm happy to send the information. I have some information if people are interested in attending. And again, that's going to be on February 20th.
Thank you.
Yep.
The next meeting is March the 7th, same place. I'd like a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you.
After the meeting, I'd just like to say that I once had the experience of dealing with communicating with the public in Washington State, where the non-English speaking communities spoke. We had to deal with four languages, Tagalog, Vietnamese, Cambodian, and I forget the other one. But we had to translate from English into each of those four languages. And the only way we could be sure that there were accurate translations was to hire other people to translate them back into English.
Yeah.
And I must say, some of those languages have beautiful characters.
Yeah.